The aim of Black Mental Matters is to tell experiences with honesty. Therefore, some discussions may trigger an adverse reaction. If a discussion is beginning to upset you, we advise that you please stop listening and talk to your support team.
Welcome to another episode, episode number 46, in fact, of Black Mental Matters, the podcast designed to help us deal with mental health in the Black community. And boy, I tell you, we need it once again this past week. Just more and more shootings we hear. And then we find out a little bit later that the person may have been dealing with some type of mental health issue. The statistics show people with untreated mental health illness 16 times more likely to be killed by law enforcement, and unfortunately, by dismantling the mental illness treatment system here in America, we've turned mental health crisis from a medical issue into a police matter. Therefore, I called on my policeman, my cousin. He's a lieutenant colonel, retired commander from the Illinois State Troopers, Leonard Stallworth. And Makiba and I, we're going to chop this up and hopefully make a difference in our community. You know we need it. Black mental matters. Black Mental Matters, once again, Vince the Voice, along with Makiba Reed Johnson. Hey, Makiba.
Hey, Vince the Voice Bailey.
Hey, good times to have you back on the lines again. How you doing? Everything good?
Yeah, everything is good. It's great to be back on the line with you, and especially with the special guest that we have.
Yes.
I'm excited.
Yeah, special guest today. I do want to go back just a little bit. That Audacity of Hope, I really liked that, our last show. Mm-hmm. You know, it gave me some hope as I listened to it again. So hats off to you. Hats off to you. And Yes, we do. We have a very special guest on the line, Leonard Stallworth, retired commander with the Illinois State Trooper, but more so than that, he's my oldest baby boy and my first cousin. That's the real deal. Hey, cuz.
Hey, cuz. How you doing, Ben?
Good. Well, this all came together. So we're recording this past weekend. You called me, Leonard, regarding the situation in Lafayette, Louisiana, where this young man, was shot by the police and subsequently died. And your question, no one knew at that time. You said, well, man, I wonder if that was the, you know, did he have mental health issues? And we had a short conversation about that. What struck you again, since that's where we started this conversation, Lynn, what struck you about that made you want to pick up the phone and even just start talking about it at that time?
Right. And because we've talked about this before, Vince, and I am so happy to be on the line with Sister Makiba, you know, listening to her background. And I got my master's in sociology with, you know, focus on urban research. And I actually wrote my lit review on policing the mentally ill. So when I hear about instances like this, you know, that happened in Louisiana, that's the first thing, you know, when I saw the details. And of course, you know, I don't know that the investigation's not been done. I don't know all of the details. But when I heard them, you know, I'm thinking to myself, was this person, you know, were they suffering of a mental illness? And it's so unfortunate because we know that today, you know, research shows that 1 in 6 adults in this country suffers from some form of a mental illness, be it a mild depression, all the way up to, you know, schizophrenia. So we know that. And now that we don't have those huge state facilities that we had back in the mid-1900s, all the way through the 1970s, mm-hmm. We don't have those facilities any longer where people could be cared for and housed and receive the right treatment and therapy. We don't have those. So those people are left on their own in the public, and that can make for a bad situation.
That's what really struck me when you said that when we were talking the other day on the phone, that the the institutions, mental health institutions, have been on the decline. And as I looked it up, I think it was in 1981 under Reagan, it really took a dive. They pulled the funding. And then after that, I'm driving home and I see a homeless man. He's dancing between the cars. It just filled me up. I don't know. When we talk about all these situations with the police, I don't know what could be even on the minds of the police as they approach people, that whether they knew that they had a mental illness or not, how you deal with situations like that. And a lot of tragedy going on right now. Another shooting is taking place in Kenosha, Wisconsin, now that we're recording.
Oh, yes.
You know, another one. So you talk about crisis intervention, training with police departments, but that's not the only answer.
No, I would agree with you. And you know what? The first thing I did when I heard about the Louisiana case, I went on Lafayette PD's website just to see if it shows that their officers have gone through that CIT training, you know, the crisis intervention team training. It didn't show, but that's not to say that they don't have it. But right now, I mean, that is a key piece in addressing this, the police interaction with the mentally ill, a subject that's suffering from going through a crisis. You know, that training is key because I'm going to tell you, you know, someone could be going through a crisis and just the presence of a police officer can set them off.
Yes.
Would you agree, McKeeb? I mean, just the presence of the police can set them off.
Oh, no. Yes, no, you're absolutely right, because what we're talking about here is the powder keg of bringing policing into the mental health arena and how just right now Black people are having a hard time feeling safe with no mental illness with police intervention. Yes. I mean, we have peaceful, you know, people just driving down the road. I mean, I have two Black sons who, I mean, I'm terrified every time they get in their car. So what we have here is the issue of the police force that already has a problem with violence and racism against Black people outside of that mental health situation. And when you bring in that mentally ill component, that escalates that situation so much further, because on the training end of the police, yes, the police have probably, for the most part, not been trained. There aren't experts coming in with them like you would have. I always think of like hostage situations in movies where they bring in the de-escalation team and, you know, they're trying to talk the person down, and the amount of patience and training and psychological knowledge that has to go into that. And then you look at where we are now with Black America and, you know, the racism and violence with the police. And then you take us who, you know, if you are experiencing a mental health crisis, not only are we afraid of the police, but a lot of us don't understand what's going on with ourselves with mental health, because we're not talking about it within our families. And there are people with family members who have autism and Asperger's syndromes and bipolar disorder and all types of mental health issues that we don't openly talk about. And so when you bring in a person that's having a crisis and then you bring in the police, it usually ends up in a situation where it escalates the problem more than it solves it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Normally when there's a 911 call and that involves a medical emergency, who goes out? You have a squad of trained emergency medical technicians or EMTs. But when a 911 call goes out involving a mentally ill subject, and oftentimes the police officer that's going to be responding, they may or may not know, dispatch may or may not let them know that, and they arrive on the scene, and the first thing they see is an individual that's ramped up already, that may have a weapon, may have a knife, similar, you know, to the incident in Louisiana. And now, what do you do? You know, what do you do? You know, if you've not had that crisis intervention training, if you've not had that, your first instinct is going to be to attempt to apprehend that subject. So you don't know if that subject is going through an episode. You don't know if they're intoxicated. You don't know if they're on some kind of drug. And the worst case scenario would be if that individual is non-compliant in taking their medication for their mental illness. And a lot of times they'll be non-compliant, and what do? They'll take drugs or alcohol to try to make themselves feel better. And it's that co-occurrence that makes a situation just astronomically worse. And they might not even know that they're going through an episode or a crisis, you know, because of the medication that they're on. It might be wearing off. They might be becoming accustomed to that medication, and they don't even know that they're in a crisis. But if they're taking drugs and alcohol in addition to going through a crisis, that's a recipe for disaster. Any police officer will tell you that the most dangerous call you can go on is a call involving a mentally ill subject.
You know, I ran across a very interesting article in the Huffington Post. It's entitled, Do I Need to Call the Police? And it talks about, you know, this last situation. And then we had one here in Gwinnett County where I guess the neighbor said that folks was talking too loud. This woman was just tased. The police officer was fired. It was a terrible situation. But you know, should I call the police? What should I do? Because in some instances, in some of these quotes here from people, they're saying, man, if I'd have never dialed the police officer department, she'd still be alive. He'd still be alive.
Wow.
So you got that whole dynamic in it.
Right.
And that's bad because people, when they see something like that, that's their, you know, the natural response. Call the police. And when the police get there, it could be even if it's not a mentally ill subject, a lot of times people will call the police and it's a civil matter. People want something done. They don't want to hear, well, this is a civil matter, or this subject is having an episode, or they want something done. And if that officer hasn't had proper training, and you look in the past, a police academy, there would be only maybe 2% of that whole training. Now, when I went through the academy, it was like 6 months. But back in the day, there may have been 2% of that training involving how to handle a mentally ill subject. Back in the day, that has changed dramatically now, where there's a lot of focus on that because law enforcement executives know this is something that's in the forefront, and we have to know how to handle these issues. Everybody's going through this training now, the crisis intervention teams and that. And, you know, that involves not only the dispatcher. So say, for instance, a call comes in for a mentally ill subject. The dispatcher knows they've had the training. The police officer on the street knows he or she has had the training. The hospital, which now will have a no drive-by policy. There's times when a police officer will bring a mentally ill subject, someone suffering, bring them to a hospital, and hospital emergency staff, well, nope, can't bring them here. Nope, there are designated hospitals and facilities. They can't turn you away. They can't turn. So you can take that person there to get proper care. And then the final component is the family. The family has to be involved in this because they'll know if their loved one has been compliant and taking their medications. They'll know what medications, you know, that person's on. So with those four components together, we can decriminalize the mentally ill, because now, you know, a lot of times police officers will just lock them up and that's another arrest. They don't need that. They don't need that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was reading that, and this was alarming to me. In 2016, a quarter of all fatal police shootings nationwide involved people with behavioral health or substance use conditions. That always brings the question to my mind is, why are the police the first ones to take the call? In order to really look at this, I mean, we have to really look at how people view the mentally ill, because just what you were saying, a lot of people, when they are calling, that person contained, because they're a lot of times is a level of fear and lack of understanding and lack of education. People don't know what they're seeing. And so that is what leads to the altercations, because people just don't know what they're seeing. And then the police are thinking about keeping the area safe, keeping onlookers and people around in the area safe. And they're also thinking about keeping themselves safe so they can make it back home to their families. So you're absolutely right. This is going to take more than just the police showing up. And I would even go a little bit further. I think that if there is going to be training, that it can't be just a one-time workshop and then there's no more training. Right. There has to be continuing education, because we're learning more and more about mental health. We're learning more about the intersectionality between different groups, different ethnic groups that experience mental illness differently, and it might look different in different cultures. So definitely there needs to be something where we look at this system of why and how we got here, and look at how we need to start circling back around to make sure that if you are having a heart attack, and you compare that to a person who's having a psychiatric break, that person that's having the psychiatric break should have the same level of compassion and professionalism as the person that's being picked up for the cardiac arrest.
Well, and
not treated like they are some type of criminal because they're sick.
I think this goes back, Leonard, to where our conversation was again, and what you talked about, and that's the deinstitutionalization of our mental health community. And now they're out of hospitals, and now they're into jails and prisons and on the streets. Talk about that a little bit, Leonard. I know you've done your due diligence on that.
Well, for instance, where I live in Illinois. Cook County, the largest county in the state, and I don't know, maybe the third largest in the nation, but Cook County Jail has a hospital on the facility. That hospital is the largest mental health facility in the state of Illinois.
Wow.
On the premises of the jail. Mm. On the premises. They are the largest mental health facility in the state of Illinois. When we talk about that institutionalism, back in the 1970s, when they were trying to decentralize those places, they promised, our government promised, well, we're going to close down these huge facilities, but we're going to have local outpatient facilities all over the country. That never happened. So we are relying on those, I'm going to call them victims, that are suffering from episodes, suffering from crises. We're relying on them to walk into one of those imaginary outpatient facilities to get the proper care, therapy, and medication they need. It's not happening. And the people are, it's very dangerous to have people like that walking around. It's dangerous to the citizenry, but then it's inhumane for that person to be suffering with an episode out on their own in public. It's inhumane.
I totally agree with what you're saying. I also think that the process should be measured, because I think that what doesn't happen a lot of times is when a person has been picked up from their home because they're having a psychiatric break, and they take them to the ER and they take them to psychiatric respite, that after that happens, there's never any follow-up with, okay, hi, patient so-and-so, we're just following up to find out, how was your experience? Did this help you? What kind of treatment are you receiving now? It needs to be comprehensive, with a circle back to that person, to make sure that the way that we're handling and trying to manage the mental health crisis with the police being involved, we need to make sure that it is effective in the eyes of the person that was apprehended, who had the mental health crisis, and that person's family and support system. Because what happens is that, we're just basically just calling the police every time that we interact with a mentally ill person, and we're not making sure that the underlying root was treated.
Well, the numbers, you talk about it being accountable. So what, 650 community health facilities in 1977, Jimmy Carter signs the Medical Health Systems Act in 1980. But then in 1981, Reagan came in and cut the funding by 30%. The study finds in 84, 30% of the homeless people are suffering from serious mental illnesses. 85, federal funding drops another 11% for community mental health facilities. Great Recession in 2009, states cut $4.35 billion in public health, mental health spending. And as of, it's even less now. In 2010, there was about 14 beds per 100,000 people in the United States in a psychiatric facility. So those numbers you can't argue with. It is definitely less resources. And as a result, we're seeing many, many more instances that are not right, that are wrong, and people are being hurt in a tremendous kind of way.
As you read those numbers off, I thought about a stat that I had looked at. In 1955, there were approximately 560,000 people, with mental illnesses housed in public mental health hospitals.
Yes.
560,000 in 1955. The population in the U.S. was only 165 million. It was half of what the population is today.
Wow.
But those 560,000 people, those facilities aren't there anymore. And, and those facilities, they not only housed and cared for people, gave them treatment and that, but there was training. There were farms where those residents could grow their own food. Everything they ate, they produced. Well, you know what? Local businesses saw the money-making ability in that, and they start selling their products food and produce to those facilities direct, and it stopped all of those training programs.
Mm.
So, you know, when you look at things like that, just because there was a way to make money, those people who were getting not only the treatment, but they were getting, having the ability to grow their own food, and they were getting training in there. Mm. And for that to stop, you know, you look at all of those different factors, and it all feeds into where we are today.
I have always felt like the mentally ill population, that community is the last frontier as far as civil rights. It just seems like so many people view the mentally ill as just people to be discarded because people, they make you uncomfortable. If you've ever been in a psychiatric ward or around, you know, a person that's schizophrenic, they make the people around them feel, you know, awkward because people aren't used to interacting with the mentally ill. So they're usually just thrown away or housed, and people don't want to see them anymore. And they don't want to think about them anymore. And that's why it was so easy for that funding to be cut, because of the lack of education as far as people really having a good understanding of the mentally ill, and also having a sense of compassion and also empathy for these people. I mean, these are kids, they're adults, all across ethnic lines. I mean, they are the last population of people that really don't have rights because they're not able to speak up for themselves.
Yes. When it comes down to it, that's really the heart, I think, of all, so many things right now. I mean, Leonard, you know, public servants, you know, we're here to, not public business, you know, just because they found out that the mentally ill can grow some vegetables now. Oh, let's sell it. You know, no, that's not what it's all about. And it's telling me NAMI's latest numbers are saying that 43.8 million adults right now in the U.S. experience mental illness each year. Now, what does that mean, an episode or what? But 43.8 million people. And if the funding, people talk about defund the police or defund this, we need to refund and get back into helping our, and as you alluded earlier, Makibas, it's even more difficult in Leonard, in our community, in the Black community, because of course it's the stigma and we're not talking about it, and we hiding and putting it up under the, and then next thing you know, we're on the news because little man got shot by the police yesterday.
You know, as I wore a uniform for 31 years before I retired. You know, I loved being the police. Every day, you know, gave me an opportunity to serve someone, to help someone. And then being a Black man, I know what it's like to come up behind you. You know, before I became the police, I know that fear. And then, but I'm a Christian first and foremost, so I know what my role is as, when I was a police officer, and as a Christian, I know what my role is. When I talk to young Black folks, I try to tell them being a police is difficult right now because some of the mistakes that have been made in our criminal justice system, it has not been fair. It has never been fair. We know that. But we know that there are police officers out there, they're on the job because they want to serve the public. That's what they want to do. And that's what their job is. Unfortunately, there is a few. And what our problem is right now is we're finding out who those few bad officers are. When I say few, I mean very few. There are 800,000 police officers in the United States right now. And these few bad officers that should be in another line of work, they shouldn't be police officers.
Right.
We don't want to find out who they are and lose a Black life. This is not algebra. Saying that on this side of the X, this is a bad cop. We've arrested, we've indicted him. On this side of the X, or the equal sign, there's another Black person that lost their life. It should not equal out to that. Just because we find an officer who might not supposed to be on the job, we don't want to lose a life doing that. So I try to tell young people, comply. I know what you see in the news, but all those officers are not like that. Don't get in arguments with the police. Don't do that. Know how to properly make a complaint. If you feel that your rights were violated, know how to go after the incident, after you clear the scene, know how to go in and speak to a shift commander. Bring your mom or dad with you, but do not get into an altercation with a police officer on the side of the road. That's not a good thing to do. And the officer could be dead wrong, but don't handle that on the side of the road.
See, I really appreciate you wanting to continue to spread the information, Leonard, because obviously it is needed. We're having so many incidents. I mean, each day it almost seems like now, Makiba, we read about somebody else, and you yourself, like you say, anytime your sons leave the house, we're terrified.
Yes,
we're terrified. What could happen?
And that might be another conversation, but we as a people have not collectively come together to have a unified response to uncomfortable police situations. And we need to go over that, you know, as a community, because there are certain things, you're absolutely right, Leonard, that we cannot do. I've actually seen a police officer pushed by a white woman in a situation where I myself was with another group of people who had found an elderly woman on the side of the road, and she was crying, she couldn't get her car moving, so we all stopped to try to help her, and a white woman in the crowd got angry because she was upset about how the officer was talking to her, and she physically pushed the officer, and we were all expecting a shootout after that point. But but nothing went down.
Karen
she was just,
up.
You know, politely asked to go back to her car, yeah, and that was the end of that. But we can't. Leonard, I don't know if Vince told you, but my cousin was Sandra Bland, and and because she was an activist, and she took her activism with her wherever she went, and she was extremely aware of what was going on when she was pulled over. And of course, you know, she's speaking in terms of inequality and racial profiling, which ended up escalating the situation where another person could have had that conversation with that police officer and gone home. So we have not gotten to the place where if you're in the military and you're captured on enemy lines, you are trained to say name, rank, serial number. Like, there are certain things you are trained when you are in the eyes and in the company and the grip of the enemy. We need to figure out collectively how we uniformly get out of these situations with the police safely, things to do, things not to do, and actually practice them with our families, with our kids, with one another. Because no, you're absolutely right. You can lose your life just for being upset because you were wrongfully pulled over. And you're absolutely right, Leonard, when you say we have to de-escalate the situation, unfortunately, and you got to swallow your pride there on the spot, so that you can go home alive.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time here, but Leonard, I want to give you the last word. Again, I really appreciate you putting this on our minds. And again, I think this push to increase facilities, residential facilities for the mentally ill, I think is a very worthwhile cause. And thank you for what you're doing. But I'll give you the last word, Leonard, as it relates to this discussion we've been having today.
Well, thanks, Vince. And it was really an honor, you know, being on the call with Sister Makiba. It was a pleasure listening, hearing you coming from the medical side. But I just want the listeners to know that law enforcement right now, they're going through a difficult time. But at the same time, those heads of those departments are working on programs and policies to make sure that these incidents just decrease and, you know, we can eliminate those incidents. And it's through technology we're looking at, you know, how to address these issues. And even on the medical, or I should say the mental illness part, there's biomedical technology that they're looking at on how to determine through a skin patch, and they can remotely check to make sure a person's taking their medication. Legislators are looking, having legislative efforts on how states can say they can mandate that individuals who have mental illnesses that they take their medication, but also having legislation to decriminalize mental illness. And that means having law enforcement and medical professionals work together so that all mental illness people suffering from them, they're not going to be in the system. We can remove them from the system and treat them the way that they're supposed to be treated.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Commander, for joining us here today at any time.
And it's Lieutenant Colonel, but that's okay. Lieutenant Colonel. Give me my money.
I know that's right. Well, thanks so much, guys.
Right.
And thank you, Makiba. And hey, we'll have this discussion again. I want you folks to be thinking about this because this is a part of our community. And as we know, Black Lives Matter and Black Mental Matters as well. Have a great day, everyone.
Amen. Thank you.